This podcast is brought to you by the Legarten Institute. I'm Sianne Hansen, Executive Director, and we hope you enjoy this conversation.
I am thrilled to be welcoming Michael to Legarten Institute here today to deliver his first public speech as the Lord Chancellor and Secretary of State for Justice. When I became Executive Director about a year ago, I wanted to ensure that the Legarten Institute established itself as one of the leading international think tanks in the UK. And it gives me enormous pleasure to welcome you all here today. This is one of a number of events that we will be hosting with policymakers from across the world. But today, the Secretary of State will be discussing a one-nation justice system. This chimes with Legarten Institute's own mission, that is, to enable people to live more prosperous lives. Rule of law underpins functioning democracies, and we look forward to hearing what Michael has to say. Now, for those of you who are on Twitter, the hashtag is BetterJustice. And without further ado, please, a warm welcome for the Secretary of State.
Thank you. Thank you very much for coming along this morning. I'd like to begin by thanking the Legarten Institute for giving me a platform today. The Legarten Institute has a formidable leadership troika of Sianne Hansen, Christina O'Donoghue, and Anne Applebaum. And they've been inspirational in the way in which they've led the Legarten Institute by affirming their commitment to two principles very close to my heart, principles essential to the argument that I want to make today. They have been brave and consistent champions of the rule of law. The Legarten Institute has already done fantastic work showing how establishing the institutions which safeguard the rule of law is the best way to rescue disadvantaged and developing societies from misgovernment and poverty. And Sianne, Christina and Anne have also been visionary in helping to establish The Good Right with my friend Tim Montgomery. The Good Right is a project designed to show how conservative politics can be progressive and emancipatory. Making the case for the rule of law as an institution valued by conservatives and which safeguards progressive values is my mission. And I'm here today to talk about how we can make the justice system work for everyone in this country. Yesterday, the Prime Minister set out his vision for a one-nation Britain. He explained how this government will extend opportunity across the country. Today, I want to begin to outline, and I stress begin, what a one-nation justice policy should look like. When the country handed the Conservative Party the responsibility of governing just over a month ago, it was on the basis that we had fought the election as a modern, compassionate Conservative Party who hoped to make opportunity more equal across society. We wanted to make sure that every citizen of the United Kingdom felt that they were equal partners in one nation. And it's on that basis that the Prime Minister asked me to lead a programme of reform at the Ministry of Justice, to make our justice system work better for victims, to deliver faster and fairer justice for all citizens, to make sure our system of family justice safeguards children, especially those at risk of abuse and neglect, more effectively than ever, to make sure that the laws we pass provide protection for the weakest, and to make our prisons places of rehabilitation, which give those who've made the wrong choices opportunities for redemption, to help offenders when they leave custody, to make the right choices and to contribute to society, to rescue young offenders and those who may be on the path to offending from a life of crime, and to reform our human rights legislation, better to protect the fundamental freedoms that we all cherish. But before saying a little more about what I think may need to change, it's critically important that I stress what needs to be protected, preserved, and enhanced. And I should in particular express my thanks to my two immediate predecessors in this role, for the work that they have already done to reform our justice system. Ken Clark and Chris Grayling introduced changes to family and to criminal justice, to prisons and to probation, which has seen the time children wait to be taken into care reduced, crime fall, prisons become better managed, and rehabilitation modernised. I'm in their debt. And I am conscious, as they always were, that there is something distinctive about the role of Lord Chancellor, different from other cabinet posts. The most important thing that I need to defend in this job, at all costs, is not a specific political position, but the rule of law. The rule of law is the most precious asset of any civilized society. It's the rule of law which protects the weak from the assault of the strong, which safeguards the private property on which all prosperity depends, which makes sure that when those who hold power abuse it, they can be checked, which protects family life and personal relations from coercion and aggression, which underpins the free speech on which all progress, scientific and cultural, depends, and which guarantees the essential liberty that allows us all as individuals to flourish. In these islands, we are fortunate that the rule of law is embedded in our way of life. An Englishman's word is his bond, his home is his castle, and Jack's as good as his master. The principles that contracts should be honored, property rights respected, and all are equal before the law are customary. They're in the deep fabric of our culture. And woven into that fabric have been the events in our history when the principles of the rule of law have been asserted by the heroes and heroines who are the real makers of our nation. The sealing of Magna Carta, the calling of the first parliament by Simon de Montfort, the establishment of habeas corpus, the challenge to the operation of the Star Chamber in early Stuart times, the fight by parliament against the crown under Charles I, the Glorious Revolution, the Bill of Rights, the judgment of Lord Mansfield that affirmed that the air of England was too pure for any slave to breathe, Catholic emancipation, the removal of discrimination against Jewish citizens, universal suffrage, and the principle of judicial review of the executive. All of these are acts which have contributed to making us who we are, a people bound by rules and guided by precedent, who settle issues by debate in parliament and argument in courts, and who afford equal protection to all and cherish liberty as a birthright. These historic acts are what constitute our nation. They are our constitution. And it is my duty as Lord Chancellor to safeguard the principles that underlie that constitution. The rule of law is so precious and so powerful in our eyes because of our history. But it is also a precious and powerful asset for a modern nation seeking to maximize its citizens' welfare in a fast-changing world. We're fortunate in England and Wales that the world again and again chooses our courts to resolve its disputes. We're fortunate that the reputation of our independent judiciary, the quality of our barristers and solicitors, the centuries-old respect for due process that characterizes our legal system, and the total absence of corruption in our courts and tribunals have all made England and Wales the best place in the world when it comes to resolving matters by law. As a result of that global leadership, we as a nation earn over £20 billion a year from the provision of legal services. So, both as a matter of enlightened economic self-interest and as a matter of deep democratic principle, it is vital that the institutions which sustain and uphold the rule of law are defended and strengthened. That means vigilance to make sure the judiciary maintain their independence and their insulation from politics. It requires understanding of the importance of a healthy, independent bar to make sure of high-quality advocacy. It also means awareness of the special virtues of an adversarial criminal justice system, with arguments tested in open court and guilt having to be proven beyond reasonable doubt before an individual's liberty is curtailed. It also means appreciation of the scrupulous patience, intellectual diligence, and culture of excellence which characterizes the work of those solicitors and barristers who support commercial endeavor and innovation. Our position of world leadership in the provision of legal services will only become more important as innovation gathers pace, as new patents are developed, new companies are created, new deals are struck, new mergers and acquisitions take place, new enterprises grow, and new opportunities arise. So making sure that we retain that position of global preeminence in legal services is one of my responsibilities. But even as we can, collectively, take pride in the fact that our traditions of liberty are generating future prosperity, we must also acknowledge that we need to do much more. Despite our deserved global reputation for legal services, not every element of our justice system is world-beating. While those with money can secure the finest legal provision in the world, the reality in our courts for many of our citizens is that the justice system is failing them, badly. There are two nations in our justice system at present. On the one hand, the wealthy international class, who can, for example, choose to settle cases in London with a gold standard of British justice. And then everyone else, who have to put up with a creaking, outdated system to see justice done in their own lives. The people who are let down most badly by our justice system are those who must take part in it through no fault or desire of their own. Victims and witnesses of crime and children who've been neglected and abused. While it's right that we should respect the traditions that underpin our legal system, that help guarantee respect for individual freedom and equality before the law, it's also undeniable that our courts are trapped in antiquated ways of working that leave individuals at the mercy of grotesque inefficiencies and reinforce indefensible inequalities. Her Majesty's Courts and Tribunal Service is exactly what its name implies, a service available for public use. And like any other public service, it must be subject to reform so that we can deliver value for money for taxpayers and fair treatment for all citizens. That's not happening at the moment. I have seen barristers struggle to explain why a young woman who had the courage to press a rape charge should have had to wait nearly 2 years before her case was heard. Reporting these offences in the first place must be a traumatic experience, made worse still by having to relieve it in court 2 years later. And I've watched as judges question advocates about the most basic procedural preliminaries in what should be straightforward cases and find that no one in court can provide satisfactory answers. I've heard too many accounts of cases derailed by the late arrival of prisoners, broken video links, or missing paperwork. I've seen both prosecution and defence barristers in a case that touched on an individual's most precious rights acknowledge that each had only received the massive bundles in front of them hours before, and through no fault of their own, were very far from being able to make the best case possible. I'm thinking of those huge bundles, those snowdrifts of paper held in place by delicate pink ribbons. Indeed, thinking of the mounds of paper forming palisades around the hard-pressed staff who try to bring some sense and order to the administration of justice, it's impossible not to wonder what century our courts are in. Were Mr. Tulkinghorn to step from the pages of Bleak House, or Mr. Jaggers to be transported from the chapters of Great Expectations into a Crown Court today, they would find that little had changed since Dickens satirised the tortuously slow progress of justice in Victorian times. It's hardly defensible anymore. Indeed, I cannot think of anyone who would want to defend the protracted series of full-dress court appearances required before really quite straightforward criminal cases are tried. In our criminal courts, barristers, judges, clerks and ushers all must be present, indeed must be physically convened together for a preliminary hearing, perhaps often delayed, and then a plea and case management hearing, perhaps also further delayed, before the case itself has any chance to be heard. Along the way, it's not uncommon that papers or other evidence that should have been served by the Crown Prosecution Service will be late or missing. Interviews may not have been transcribed. Arrangements to call witnesses may be uncertain. And then when the trial itself is due to begin, it's entirely possible that pleas may change at the last minute. Witnesses may not turn up. The whole protracted, expensive, bewildering enterprise may end with no justice being done and nothing but confusion seen to be done. The number of trials that collapse before going ahead, or collapse as they proceed, is huge. Across both magistrates and Crown Courts, almost one in five trials, 17%, are ineffective, meaning the required court hearing does not happen on the day, often due to administrative issues, and that the trial then needs to be rearranged. Last year, there were more than 33,000 ineffective trials in our criminal courts. Almost two in five trials, 37%, are cracked, meaning that the case concludes unexpectedly without a planned court hearing. Of course, it is often preferable to resolve cases before they reach court. But when guilty pleas are entered only on the day, you have to ask whether the matter could have been resolved sooner and taken up less time, money and resource. That leaves less than half of cases, 46%, which are actually deemed effective. We must do better. And the people who experience this inefficiency every day are the staff who work in our courts and tribunals and valiantly keep the system working despite its flaws. Across England and Wales, dedicated court staff cope with the snow drifts of paper, archaic IT systems, and cumbersome processes. We would have no justice without them, and they feel the frustrations of the current system most keenly and understand the case for reform most powerfully. The waste and inefficiency inherent in such a system are obvious, but perhaps even more unforgivable is the human cost. It's the poorest in our society who are disproportionately the victims of crime, and who find themselves at the mercy of this creaking and dysfunctional system. Women who have the bravery to report domestic violence, assault, and rape. Our neighbours who live in those parts of our cities scarred by drug abuse, gangs, and people trafficking. These are the people who suffer twice, at the hands of criminals and as a result of our current criminal justice system. A slow system's bad not just for the lawyers, court staff and judiciary who handle these cases, or for victims of crime who've suffered terrible abuse. It is also, we should stress, disruptive and in some cases life-destroying for those who are subsequently found not guilty, but only after they have lost months, if not years of their lives, in legal limbo. We urgently need to reform our criminal courts. We need to make sure that prosecutions are brought more efficiently, unnecessary procedures are stripped out, information is exchanged by email or conference call rather than a series of hearings, and evidence is served in a timely and effective way. Then we can make sure that more time can be spent on ensuring that the court hears high-quality advocacy rather than excuses for failure. The case for reform is overwhelming, which should not surprise us, because it is made most powerfully and most clearly by the judiciary themselves. The Lord Chief Justice and his colleagues, who provide leadership to our justice system, are all convinced of and convincing on the case for reform. They have commissioned work which makes the case for quite radical change. Should anyone doubt the need for dramatic steps, Sir Brian Leveson's report on the need for change in our criminal justice system makes the case compellingly. He argues with great authority and makes a series of wise recommendations. They need to be implemented with all speed. It's my intention to do everything I can to support the Lord Chief Justice, Sir Brian, and his colleagues in their work. Not for the first time in our history, it is our judges who see most clearly what needs to be done to help the vulnerable, the overlooked, and the victimised in our society. But it is not just in the criminal courts that the case for reform is clear, and not just in the criminal courts that the judiciary are leading the way. Outside of our criminal courts, millions of individuals every year use our courts to deal with injustice in their everyday lives, whether challenging unscrupulous landlords, reaching custody arrangements after divorce, agreeing liability of a failed contract, or settling a dispute over intellectual property rights, worth everything to the parties involved. Our courts matter. Without our civil and family courts, or our tribunal services, our contracts are unenforceable, and individuals are left with no recourse when deprived of their rights. But it astonishes businesses and individuals alike that they cannot easily file their case online. And it astounds them that they cannot be asked questions online and in plain English when they go to law, rather than on paper and in opaque and circumlocutory jargon. The current system adds distress at times of need and restricts access to high-quality resolution of disputes by simply being too complex, too bureaucratic, and too slow. Across our court and tribunal system, we need to challenge whether formal hearings are needed at all in many cases. We need to speed up decision-making, give all parties the ability to submit and consider information online, and consider simple issues far more proportionately. Thanks to pioneering work which the judiciary have commissioned from reformers like Professor Richard Tuskind, there is now a huge opportunity to take many of these disputes online. Questions which have previously required expensive court time and often, as a result, have been marked by acrimony, bitterness, and depleted family resources, can now be resolved more quickly, efficiently, and harmoniously. Sir James Mundy, the president of the Family Division, envisages that the complex, sometimes fraught, and certainly disorientating process of applying for probate or dealing with family separation or divorce could be far more quickly and sensitively handled. By using plain English rather than legalese, replacing paper forms with simple questions online, and automating much of the administrative process, many issues could be resolved far more quickly, often without the involvement of administrators or the judiciary. That would free the time of Sir James and his colleagues for the most vital work of the family court, deciding whether it is in the best interest of children who may have suffered neglect or abuse to remain with their birth families or to be placed in the care of foster or adoptive parents. The reform programme which the judiciary want to implement is being planned now. We've already committed to invest in the technology which will underpin it. This reform programme could liberate tens of thousands of individuals from injustice and free hundreds of thousands of hours of professional time. Online solutions and telephone and video hearings can make justice easier to access and can reduce the need for long and often multiple journeys to court. And we can reduce our dependence on an ageing and ailing court estate, which costs, at the moment, around one-third of the entire courts and tribunals budget. Inevitably, that will mean looking again at our court estate. It's still the case that many of our courts stand idle for days and weeks on end. Last year, over a third of courts and tribunals sat for less than 50% of their available hours, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. At a time when every government department has to find savings, it makes more sense to deliver a more efficient court estate than, for example, to make further big changes to the legal aid system. Legal aid is a vital element in any fair justice system, and there is a responsibility on government to make sure that those in the greatest hardship, at times of real need, are provided with the resources to secure access to justice. So I know how controversial the changes that we have made to legal aid have been, but I also believe that those changes do need to be judged fairly. The coalition government sought to make sure that legal aid remained available for critically important cases, where people's life or liberty is at stake, where they face the loss of their home, in cases of domestic violence, or where their children may be taken into care. And when I came to office, I made sure that the changes that my predecessor had put in place to guarantee access to legal advice across the country were implemented. I also made sure that the criminal bar were protected from further cuts, so that the high quality advocacy they provide could be supported. Change was required to save money. No minister in this government can avoid thinking hard about how to deal with a massive deficit that the Labour government's left us. But I'm also committed to making sure that we protect access to justice for everyone accused of a crime and safeguard and improve the quality of the legal advice and advocacy in our criminal courts. I am particularly keen to make sure that the highest quality advocates are instructed in all cases, and I've set in train immediate work to address the problems described in Sir Bill Jeffrey's report on criminal advocacy last year. And I want to make sure that once changes to criminal legal aid are in place, we monitor their effects to make sure that justice and fairness are served. That is why we will review the impact of these changes to legal aid, both on the quality of advocacy and access to justice. And that's why I'm determined to do everything I can to protect and to enhance both. A One Nation justice policy requires no less. But a One Nation approach to justice cannot be blind to the fact that while resources are rationed at one end of our justice system, rewards, as I mentioned earlier, are growing at the other end. The global leadership in legal services I referred to and took vicarious pride in at the beginning of my speech has made a large number of organisations and individuals in this country very successful. There's no doubt that in the market for legal expertise, we are reaping the benefits of Britain's huge competitive advantage. But the law is more than a marketplace. It is a community. The legal profession is more than a commercial enterprise. It is a vocation for those who believe in justice being done. The belief in the rule of law and the commitment to its traditions, which enabled this country to succeed so handsomely in providing legal services, is rooted in a fundamental commitment to equality for all before the law. So those who have benefited financially from our legal culture need to invest in its roots. That's why I believe that more could and should be done by the most successful in the legal profession to help protect access to justice for all. I know that many of the most prestigious chambers at the bar and many of the top solicitors' firms already contribute to pro bono work and invest in improving access to the profession. Many of our leading law firms have committed to give 25 hours pro bono, on average, per fee earner each year. That's welcome, but much more needs to be done. Last year, according to a survey by the Law Society, 16% of solicitors in commerce and industry provided an hour or more of pro bono work. When it comes to investing in access to justice, then it's clear to me that it is fairer to ask our most successful legal professionals to contribute a little more rather than taking more in tax from someone on the minimum wage. I want to work with leaders in the profession to examine what the fairest way forward might be, but I cannot accept that the status quo is defensible. Overall, a refusal to accept that the status quo is acceptable in our courts, in our prisons, indeed when it comes to our liberties, is the essential characteristic of a One Nation justice policy. In future speeches, I hope to outline what we need to do to make sure our prisons work much better, and to explain what needs to change in our youth justice system. I hope to be able to explore how we can prevent individuals falling into crime and how we can rescue them from a life of crime. I also want to make clear how we can better protect our rights, not least to freedom of speech and freedom of association. What will guide me is what guides our government, a belief in the principles of One Nation, respect for the traditions which make our country liberal, tolerant, and resilient. A belief that every citizen has a role to play. Every citizen has views that deserve respect, and every citizen has an essential dignity that none should compromise. A belief that opportunity should be more equal, background should be no barrier to success, and extremes of wealth and poverty scar us all. And a commitment, above all, to to helping those who have been held back by prejudice, accident or circumstance to achieve the fulfillment and happiness of rewarding work, security at home and flourishing relationships. Thank you all very much. Thank you.
The Secretary of State said that he will take a few questions, and I'm very happy to... We've got some microphones, and if you could just say who you are.
Thank you very much. Joshua Rosenberg. Secretary of State, it strikes me that this is the first time that a government minister has backed reforms to the courts proposed by the judges themselves. What happens if anything goes wrong? Who takes responsibility if, for example, there's objection to courts being closed, if there are problems with the information technology? Is this down to the judges? Is it down to the government? Or is this joint responsibility?
The buck stops here. I hope to work well, and I've certainly enjoyed working so far with the Lord Chief Justice and his colleagues on the Judicial Executive Board. And we work together. But ultimately, political responsibility and parliamentary accountability rest with me. So when things go wrong, it's my responsibility to explain why and to put them right.
The gentleman in the check shirt.
Thank you. Clive Coleman from the BBC. I think everyone would applaud the idea of a one nation where everyone has the same opportunity in terms of access to justice and representation. But there are many who work within the system who would say the best guarantor of that is to have a publicly funded legal service whereby people have access to the best legal representation, and that the cuts that we've seen, the best part of £500 million being taken out of legal aid, denies that to people. And that's the really critical issue.
In my speech, acknowledge the fact that there are many people who have expressed in good faith their concerns about changes to the legal aid system. I think some of the critics of what we've done have perhaps in the past been unfairly characterised as voices motivated by self-interest. I don't believe that's the case. I believe that people have sincerely worried that the changes that we've made may have done some harm to access to justice. The point that I would make is twofold. Firstly, it's still the case that we provide one of the most generous systems of public support through legal aid of any common law jurisdiction. People may argue over the precise figures, but it's undeniably the case that the provision is still generous and that in the most important cases it will always be there. But there's also a second point I made here, a quid pro quo. If we're going to have effective access to justice, then we need to make sure that those who have done well out of our justice system, because of their skill and talent, contribute more. And that means asking our most successful solicitors' firms and our most successful barristers' chambers to look into their own consciences and to ask themselves what more they can do in order to ensure that there is more equitable access to justice as well. As I said, the law is not just a marketplace, it is a community. And it's also the case that as a politician, when I'm thinking about where additional money might come from in order to improve access to justice, I have to weigh the fact that if I'm going to increase legal aid, that means taking more from people who pay their taxes who are on the minimum wage. And considering how well some people in the legal profession have done, I think it's only right that we should consider what we can do in order to ensure that they contribute as well.
The lady at the back in the cream jacket.
Michael, you...
Can you just say who you are?
Frances Gibb from The Times. You famously encountered resistance in the teaching profession and I think called it the blob. What is your view of lawyers, and do you expect to encounter similar resistance?
So far, I've been encouraged, heartened, and supported, actually, by lawyers. I'm very fortunate in that I have a number of lifelong friends who have devoted their life to working at the bar or in the law, and I've relied on their support and advice in doing this job, as I have relied on the support and advice of the judiciary, of individual lawyers in the field, and of course the civil servants in the Ministry of Justice. So far, I've found nothing but goodwill, wisdom, and generosity of spirit from the legal profession. I'm sure that there will be critics of some of the steps that I and the government will take in the future, but it's a privilege to be able to do this job, and one of the privileges is to be able to spend time with people whose commitment, as I mentioned earlier, to the profession often springs from, in fact, in almost all cases, springs from a vocation to see justice done.
Thank you. The gentleman in the middle with the blue suit.
Thank you. Jack Blanchard from The Mirror. A couple of quick questions, if I can. You're obviously keen to modernise the courts. Could that extend to television cameras in the courts like we see in the US? And secondly, on legal aid, I think you said you'd review the impact on the access to justice. If you find that it's had a negative impact in your view, will you publish that review and would you be prepared to put more money back in?
Well, on the first part about televising, I think that we need to proceed at a pace with which the judiciary are happy. So I've talked to the Lord Chief Justice about whether or not certain aspects of what happens in our courts might be televised, and I will be guided entirely by his and by the judiciary's views on that matter. On the review, the whole purpose of the review is to ask difficult questions. And of course, we'll make sure that that review and its findings are published in such a way as to allow people to see not just our conclusions, but our working, as it were. And if it does require a change to any aspect of the operation of the system that we have in place, then of course we will fairly implement whatever that change might need to be.
Okay. Ed, there's a gentleman in the middle and the back row.
Thank you. Owen Bocock from The Guardian. Can I ask, your predecessor said that certainly during the last election there would be no further cuts to legal aid. I mean, can you give that pledge that you have no intention of cutting legal aid any further? And when you're talking about seeking the most wealthy in the profession to contribute, will you consider putting that into legislation, or is that something that will be voluntary? Okay.
On the first part, I have no plans to make further cuts to legal aid. It may be the case that as a result of the review that there are changes which are required, but it's not my intention to cut legal aid any further for the reasons that both my predecessor and I today have outlined. On your second point, I don't want to legislate, I want to work with the profession. And I think that, in fact, I already know from some of the conversations that I've had that there is a willingness to work constructively. But of course, it's always open to us, if we need to legislate, in order to make sure that we can improve access to justice.
Any more? Lady at the back in the spotted dress. One more.
Thank you. Kate McCann at The Sun. It's on the Human Rights Act. Do you agree with Chris Grayling's conclusion that leaving the European Court of Human Rights is the only way to ensure that the Supreme Court remains supreme?
The Prime Minister's view, the whole government's view, is that we do not want to leave the jurisdiction of the court and we do not want to leave the convention, but we do want to see change and all options are open.
Any more questions? Gentleman with the pink tie.
Yeah, John Hyde from the Law Society Gazette. You talked about a review of the court estate. What would that mean in practice? And have you got any idea of sort of the scale of potential, I would assume, sort of closures that would mean?
Yes. We are going to have to close some courts. We are obviously going to consult on where, but there are some courts which are currently dramatically underused. But the important test is, can we do so in a way which improves access to justice overall? And we want to work with the judiciary in order to ensure that we can have a programme that is thoughtful and strategic and is informed by the need for reform rather than anything else.
Terrific. Gentleman in the back with the blue shirt.
Good morning. James Slack from the Daily Mail. I wonder, have you given thought to how the successful lawyers might contribute more? Is that through pro bono work or a financial contribution?
We have given some thought to that, but I think the first thing that I want to do is to be able to talk in greater detail to... I've raised one or two of these issues in conversation with members of the judiciary, with the Law Society, with the Bar Council. I want to develop ideas with them. So rather than here and now slapping a proposition on the table and inviting people to sign up to it, I want to try to work constructively. But of course we have some proposals which we hope people might buy into, and if they don't initially, then we can make the case publicly for them.
Lady in the front.
Andrea Coomber, I'm the Director of Justice. Thank you, Minister, for your comments, particularly on the civil justice system, which, as you note, is on the brink of collapse. In respect of the closure of courts, will the money or saved through closing courts be reinvested in the court process, or will it be absorbed generally in the budget of HTS?
Well, overall, the Ministry of Justice, like other government departments, has to play its part in our deficit reduction strategy. But the Treasury appreciate the importance of courts reform, and it's already been the case, even before we've made any announcements about the future of the court estate, that the Treasury have said that there is money available in order to help modernise access to justice. Her Majesty's Courts and Tribunal Service have developed a business case in order to ensure that the Treasury can commit that capital investment. So it's important to recognise that the process of closing the court's estate is part of a programme of reform which the judiciary have helped develop with us and with HMCTS. So I won't make any commitments today about final numbers of closures or the final amounts that will be realised by the eventual sale or disposal of the court's estate, but it is important to recognise that the numbers have been constructed or are being constructed in such a way as to improve and enhance access to justice.
Ed, I think this will be the last question. Anybody else? No, and then it leaves me to say thank you so much, and could we please show our appreciation for the Secretary of State? To hear more podcasts from the Legatum Institute, please visit our iTunes channel or website at www.li.com.